You're listening to the Brown Girl Podcast, a new show discussing various cultural and mainstream topics that impact our community from the perspectives of South Asian women. The show also aims to highlight South Asian women creators, business owners, and pioneers who are paving the way for future generations. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever your podcasts are found. If you're on Instagram, give us a follow at thebrowngirl_podcast to stay up to date on new releases and stay engaged with our community. Thanks for tuning in. Hey guys, welcome to the Brown Girl Podcast. My name is Julie, I'm the host of the show. This is episode number 18, and today we're talking about divorce. Divorce is something that is still considered to be very taboo in our South Asian community. It's highly stigmatized, and as a result, it's just not as common. Divorce rates are very low within South Asian populations. Even if there's violence, abuse, or other oppressive situations happening within a household, the reality of our culture is that the stigma and shame of divorce is so great that it often leads people to stay in their married arrangements rather than go through a divorce. There was a Washington Post article that was published in 2016 that estimated about 3.5 million South Asians who live in the United States, and the divorce rates of that population is estimated between 1 and 15%. At some point, I would like to have guests join the podcast who have gone through divorce themselves and speak about their experience and how they overcame it. But today we're going to have a more informative and educational session and hear from a divorce attorney. So Maliha Siddiqui is here today, and she's going to share some insight about divorce within the South Asian community, as well as the legal aspects of divorce, what you can expect, how much it costs, how alimony and child support payments are calculated. We also talk about prenups, postnups, and everything in between. A little bit about Maliha's background. She graduated from DePaul University College of Law in 2015, focusing her education on divorce and domestic violence in the Chicagoland area. She began her career by representing low-income clients through DePaul University's Family Law Clinic. Her career has spanned across legal aid clinics and some of the most prestigious law firms in Illinois. In 2019, she began representing children of highly contested custody battles as a pro bono guardian ad litem. In 2021, after realizing that clients wanted more efficiency from their legal counsel, more communication during their divorce, and culturally competent services, Maliha opened the doors to Siddiqui Family Law, LLC. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. A couple things to keep in mind. As a disclaimer, none of what you hear today is formal legal advice. The content of this episode is purely educational in nature, and divorce laws and proceedings are subject to individual state and local laws. There's also a really great online presentation that Maliha had done with the Muslim Bar Association that I had watched as part of preparation for this episode. It's really informative, has a lot of really helpful information, and I do reference it a few times throughout this episode, so I'll leave the link for that recording session in the show notes. We are live now. Okay, Maliha, thank you so much for joining us today for this episode.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So you mentioned that 90% of your clients are South Asian. I know we talked about that before recording, so let's start off by talking about, what are the common reasons for divorce within the South Asian community that you've seen within your practice and the clients that you've served?
Yeah, so I primarily represent women, and I primarily represent women who have survived some kind of domestic violence. And I think that because there is such a stigma in the South Asian community to get divorced, that people are willing to stay in toxic relationships for a lot longer than they traditionally would. And for that reason, the relationship has to be in a really, really bad situation for someone to actually reach out to a divorce attorney and decide to file and deal with that societal stigma. So I would say domestic violence is pretty common in my practice. And even if it isn't that traditional, you know, idea of domestic violence where it's physical and the cops are called, even if that doesn't exist in the case, there's a level of, you know, financial manipulation, emotional manipulation. You know, in-laws tend to get involved when it comes to a South Asian divorce. So those are the traditional themes I see. But that being said, you know, South Asian families are not immune to things like gambling, drug abuse, infidelity, and sometimes people just grow apart. So I see cases like that too.
Yeah, I mean, if we're exclusively talking about, you know, the South Asian community, divorce rates are so low. I think from like my own observation, I'm seeing divorces happening more within our millennial generation than our parents' generation. And while that's not ideal, I think that is indicative that, you know, people are not settling for an unhappy life and perhaps also breaking that cycle of, you know, accepting abuse and other horrendous situations, like you mentioned, for the sake of keeping the family pride and ego afloat. And I think that part is positive. I'm curious, like, what are some of the common profiles of your clients? Like, when you hear their stories, is it usually people who've been wanting to file for a long time but have been, you know, putting it off due to external pressures to stay?
I would say that that's true for almost everyone, including my non-South Asian clients. This is a serious decision. People don't take it lightly. They spend years thinking about it. They usually talk to multiple attorneys. They talk to their families. They really spend a lot of time considering whether or not to file for divorce. People don't take this decision lightly, which is why, I try to push back against that stigma so much. It is a traumatic experience, and the last thing you need is for, society to tell you to stay in a toxic marriage because, what would people say? So I think that's actually very common. But I don't necessarily just divorce millennials either, right? So we all know that auntie who is staying in a horrible marriage just because she feels like she has to and she doesn't have any other options. And, people of all ages are getting divorced now because, probably because of some level of assimilation and some level of normalizing the fact that divorce can maybe be in the best interest of both parties. So I divorce people who have been married for 40 years. It happens. It's always sad. The work I do is a sad line of work, frankly. I always tell my clients, the fact that you're calling me means that you've already lost. Everyone loses in a divorce, whether they lose half their assets, whether they lose parenting time with their children. And people know that. And so they take this decision very seriously.
And like you mentioned, divorce, it's such a traumatic and life-altering event for the person going through it. And I would imagine that as the divorce attorney helping them in their case, it can be also challenging just for yourself emotionally to like separate yourself from that emotional part and just focus on being, you know, the legal aid or legal counsel. So how do you kind of find that balance between the two?
I definitely struggle with it. I mean, I get attached to my clients. I'm seeing them through one of the worst things that will happen to them. And so keeping that separation is a bit of a struggle. I've gotten better at it. And ultimately, I remind them that, a therapist is cheaper than me, and I'm not qualified to actually help you with some of these emotional things. I see patterns and I can advise, people based on my experience, but at the end of the day, I'm not the person you should go to if you are, emotionally struggling. I'm the person you go to reach that finish line and break those legal ties with your spouse. So I struggle with it. I get very attached to my clients. They end up kind of being my friends. We text, at the end of the day, I need to maintain that separation for my clients' benefit as well. They need to understand, what role I play and when they should contact me so we can be as productive as possible.
Yeah. So I want to move on to some of the legal aspects of divorce. So we know that divorces are subject to state and local laws. So can you just first clarify that the state applicable is the state that you are filing in, correct? Like if you get married in Florida, but let's say later on you move and you file for divorce in Illinois, it's the Illinois law that would be applicable to your case, correct?
Yes, it doesn't matter where you got married. I mean, plenty of my clients, they got married overseas, a lifetime ago. So, where you file matters. There are also some, jurisdictional issues that allow you to file in some states based on residency. I won't bore you with those details, but yes, where you file matters.
Okay. And tell us about the typical divorce timeline, like the general timeline, steps involved, and what people can expect.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that's one of the most common questions. How long is this going to take? And I believe, actually, I practice in Illinois, and I believe Illinois actually released guidelines saying that most cases without children should settle around the 1 year mark, and most cases with children should settle around, I think, 18 months. I could be misquoting that a little bit. And I think that's a pretty good guideline. What I tell my clients is that this process requires an immense amount of patience. This resolution might be easy in your eyes, but we need to go through the process. There are a lot of steps to get to the finish line. So what I usually say is, if you don't have kids, you know, you're allowed to start complaining to me in a year. Give me a year to get you there. And if you do have kids, give me about a year and a half. I think that's a reasonable expectation. And you just need to mentally prepare yourself at the beginning. Otherwise, you're going to get frustrated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What happens in situations where, you know, one person does not want to comply with the divorce? Like, let's say wife wants to file for divorce, but husband doesn't want it. What kind of like legal mechanisms are in place that would either help or hurt the person initiating the divorce?
Yeah. So, you know, because of due process, which is essentially the principle that people have the right to participate in their court proceedings, the court will give people a lot of opportunity to participate, which translates to a case dragging a little bit. When you initially file, you have to legally serve them with the paperwork. Once they're legally served, they have, you know, in Illinois, it's 30 days to actually legally participate. And then if they fail to do that, you can, you know, you can default them, you can enter a default judgment, and you can get divorced without their consent. That's absolutely possible. I don't typically recommend that, because, you know, we don't want it to be overturned. We don't want them to later claim they didn't have notice. You know, courts will give people a lot of opportunity to participate, and they will overturn divorces. I've seen it happen. So for that reason, you know, we really want to encourage the other side to participate. And if they don't, we can still get you divorced. There's tools I have, but I usually, you know, at the top of the case, I try to work with my client. And I say, you know your ex better than I ever will. Tell me, is this the kind of person who will dodge service? Or is this the kind of person who will cooperate? And based on the feedback from my client, we can, you know, determine a strategy. Are we going to email them, give them an opportunity to participate without serving them? Or are we just going to serve them from the very top? Every case is different. But yes, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if your partner wants to participate or not. I will be able to get you divorced.
So let's talk about Kim Kardashian and Kanye West.
Okay.
Like, so, you know, their divorce case has been, it seems like, drawing out for so long. I think Kim had filed for divorce back in January of 2021 initially, and they did have a prenup. And so you'd think their process would be quicker, but like, what are some of the factors that are drawing up their case for as long as it is?
So it's my understanding that Kanye switched attorneys more than once. And I would say that's probably the most popular way to drag out a case. It requires, obviously, financial resources, patience, et cetera, but Kanye doesn't want to get divorced. So switching attorneys, every time you switch attorneys, the court gives you time to find a new attorney. So for that reason, and because of how large their estate is, I'm sure the judge gave him plenty of time to find another attorney. Yes, they have a prenup, but prenups can be invalidated. A case isn't done until, you know, a judge's stamp and signature is on a judgment for dissolution of marriage. So I don't know what games he's playing, but I will say, I know that there was some significant custody issues. Kanye was alleging that Kim was keeping him away from the kids and the birthday parties. Those type of issues also tend to drag out a case, because at the end of the day, there's no right or wrong answer when it comes to parenting time. Mm-hmm. There are right or wrong answers and very clear laws when it comes to finances, but the parenting side of things requires a lot of back and forth, a lot of negotiation, and ultimately a judge is going to give people, including Kanye, a lot of opportunity to, you know, bring up issues and let him see what he's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it possible to file for a divorce without an attorney?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you, in Illinois, there's a mechanism called a joint simplified divorce, where if you don't have kids, and I believe each party makes under $35,000, you can just fill out like some very simple forms, divide your estate, and then go your own ways. I don't do joint simplified divorces in my practice because you really don't need an attorney for that, especially if you don't have like a big marital estate. There's no need to spend your limited marital estate on attorney's fees. There's always a cost benefit when involving attorneys.
Yeah, so I've heard couples often also use like a mediator as opposed to going through an attorney because that's typically way cheaper. So can you talk to us about mediation, like what it is and how that process may be different than working with an attorney?
Yeah, so mediation is where I practice in Illinois, in Cook County specifically. Mediation is actually required when you have children and are unable to come to a resolution. So the judge will say, okay, I've given you 2 months to come up with a parenting agreement. You're not able to do it. I'm going to send you to a mediator. I'm going to send you to our county mediator and see if a neutral third party can help you out. So mediation is a great tool for people who still have some level of trust in their relationship, mm-hmm. who, you know, want to save money, who found a mediator that they truly believe is neutral. And can help them, and it can help guide them. It's not for everybody, though. You know, if you have a spouse who you think is hiding assets, or it's highly contentious and there's been violence, that's not the route you should take. You can also do both things at once. I have a lot of clients who file with me so that they're protected from the legal side, but then they also work with a private mediator, and I can attend those mediation sessions or not. You know, if my clients say, I don't trust my partner and I want you there, I'll mm-hmm. be there and I'll help guide them. Or sometimes I try to stay out of it because sometimes attorneys can cause more problems, right? Instead of mm-hmm. helping resolve it. So yeah, mediation is a really good tool to use, but it's not, you know, it's not the end all be all. At the end of the day, you should get an attorney to memorialize whatever agreement you reached in mediation. And have it, you know, submitted to the court and have that process done correctly. So, I mean, if you have children, you should always go to mediation. Let me say that.
Okay. So you said that you can do mediation in conjunction with working with an attorney.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Got mediation it. Is just a tool. It's not a separate process. It's just one of the many tools you can use.
Okay. What's the general cost range that people end up spending to complete their divorce? Like, let's say they're using attorneys. Like, what do you see people spending on that?
Yeah, so obviously every case is different. I'll always say that. And this is probably the most common question I get. How much is this going to cost? And secondary, how long is this going to take? Because attorneys charge hourly, I would say a divorce on the lower end is around $5,000. And on the higher end, I've seen it go up to over 200 grand. I mean, it just depends. It just depends on how complex your case is. If you have a marital estate worth $60 million, spending $1 million on attorney's fees is a small price to pay. You know, and I've seen that. I've seen that happen in my own practice. But it just depends on the complexity. It depends on how litigious people are. There's a lot of incentive to play nice, resolve your case and settle and avoid trial. Most people, you know, I would say over 95% of people cannot afford trial. They shouldn't go to trial. It's not in their best interests, and they can't afford it.
What kind of tips or advice do you have for lowering the cost of divorce for a couple that's thinking about going down the path of divorce?
Yeah, I mean, I would say for a couple, if they're making the decision together, you know, do mediation, sit down, discuss all your assets, have a game plan, even maybe before you talk to an attorney. But, you know, I can't represent a couple. I only represent one person. So for that one person that comes to me, I would say two things. Number one is be organized. You know, a big part of getting divorced is actually a lot of homework for the client. They have to give me oftentimes 3 to 5 years of bank statements, 3 to 5 years of credit card statements, 3 to 5 years of their 401k statement. You know, people sometimes don't even know what assets they have because a lot of it is automatic through their paycheck. So I'll say, oh, I see that you have life insurance. And they say, I had no idea I had life insurance, you know? So being organized and methodical when you speak to your attorney and when you produce documents is going to save you a lot of money. And I say that because if you are not organized and you provide those documents to me, you will then be paying my hourly rate for me to organize and analyze those documents. It seems simple, but it's actually kind of a big deal. And, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for my clients. It's a big project that gets thrown on their lap and they have children and full-time jobs and, you know, they didn't expect it. So I try to set those expectations early on that I am just a partner in this divorce. I am not the one who's able to, you know, log into your Chase bank account and download those statements for you. You have to do it. And the second thing I'll say is to be reasonable in your expectations. Like I said earlier, this is a very emotionally charged process and you might come to me and just be out for blood. You know, you're so angry, you can't think straight. And it's my job to kind of calm you down, set reasonable expectations, and for you to follow them. You might think that your ex doesn't deserve any parenting time or doesn't get a dime out of your pension. If you don't have a prenup and you decided to marry this person, you have entered into a legal contract with them. So the more reasonable you are, the less negotiation is going to happen, the less drama will happen, and I promise you it will be cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll definitely get to prenups in a bit. But speaking about the intricacies of splitting up finances, assets, and other belongings. So in the presentation that you did for the Muslim Bar Association, which I'll link in the show notes, you talked about the two main categories in the divorce process, which is the parenting category and the financial category. So parenting being the allocation of time and responsibilities of children are present, and then the financial category, which is made up of calculations surrounding three things: maintenance, which I know you mentioned used to be called alimony payments. So alimony, maintenance, same thing. And then child support payments if children are present. And then the actual division of the marital estate, which is how all the assets and debt are going to be split. So let's first start by talking about the maintenance, or aka alimony. Can you elaborate on the two components that make up calculating that maintenance payment?
Yeah, so there's a formula involved. So basically, for the amount of maintenance, you look at the amount the higher income earner makes. You know, I usually do it on a monthly basis. That's a little easier, but you can do it on an annual basis. And then you look at how much the payee, the recipient of maintenance, makes. Then you basically, you know, it's basically a formula. I have software that runs this, but if you want to do it like kind of in the like back of the napkin math, you know, you would take, I think it's 33% of the payor's income minus 25% of the payee's income, and that would be your monthly or annual maintenance payment.
Okay.
I mean, we typically do it monthly, actually. And the reason we typically do it monthly is because the duration of maintenance is, which is the second half of the maintenance formula, the duration is based on the duration of the marriage. So the longer you're married, the longer you would pay maintenance, and it grows exponentially. So when you do the calculations that way, you don't usually have round annual numbers. You usually have like you know, 2 years and 4 months, which is why we calculate maintenance on a monthly basis.
Okay, got it. So if we look at a very simple example, I kind of wish we had like a whiteboard here, but let's say hypothetically, husband's net income is 200,000, the wife's net income is 100,000, and so they get divorced, and now the husband owes the wife maintenance. So based on that formula, 33% of the husband's 200,000 is going to be 66,000. 25% of the wife's 100,000 income is going to be 25,000. The difference between that is 41,000. So in that case, provided all of the other things are in place that make the wife in the situation eligible to receive these alimony or maintenance payments, the difference of 41,000 is the annual amount that the husband would owe the wife.
That's exactly how it works. It's a simple formula. That being said, I do want to point out what you just said, which is provided everything else is in place, which would allow the payee to be eligible to receive maintenance. So a lot of clients, they come to me and they automatically think that they are maybe maintenance candidates. And sometimes they're not, even though there's a big discrepancy of income. It could be because the payee has a lot of non-marital assets from before they got married, or she has a lot of family help, or you know, there's a million reasons why, or she's underemployed and she's choosing to be underemployed. So once you meet the burden to show that you are a maintenance candidate, that's when we step into the formula and say, okay, this is what you can generally expect, and this is how long your maintenance would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So to sum it up, how long one person has to pay maintenance is going to be based upon the length of marriage. So if you're married for 3 years versus 12 years, that you know duration is going to determine how long those maintenance payments have to be made for. And then there are separate calculations that determine the actual monthly amount that would need to be paid for that duration that is identified.
Yes.
And what happens when the payor does not pay up? Like, can they go to jail if they don't pay?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not automatic. You know, you have to drag them back into court and tell a judge, we have this order. This is what he was required to do. He's not doing it. And the judge will say, okay, I'll give them, you know, a month to get up to the full payment. And judges do give people a lot of opportunity, but some people just don't want to pay maintenance, you know, on principle. And you can put them in jail. You can garnish their wages. You can seize assets. There's all sorts of things you can do. I try to have the payments automatically deducted from their paycheck to avoid this gamesmanship. But, you know, it's not always successful. Some people are self-employed, some people are unemployed. But when possible, I try to automate all of these things to reduce drama. My goal is to reduce the probability of you returning to court after you're divorced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess the burden, though, of legally going after someone for those maintenance payments if they're not paying is with the person who's supposed to receive those payments.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. And mm-hmm. there are mechanisms as well to, you know, reimburse you for your attorney's fees and things like that. But no one wants to go back into court, you know? Yeah. So a lot of this is determined by who you ended up marrying and who mm-hmm. you ended up entering into this contract with, which is, it's unfortunate, but you just have to the law in front of us and the person that you married.
Yeah. I mean, it does feel unfortunate because I'm sure that alone can deter a lot of people from doing it in the first place because of how much work and fees that they may have to incur.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. go ahead.
Oh, and possibly risk not ever, you know, retrieving.
Yeah, I mean, we always say you can't draw blood from a stone. So even if, you know, your ex hasn't paid child support in 18 years or maintenance in 18 years and they were required to do so, I can go into court and I can get a judgment and I can do all of these sorts of things to legally protect you. But if this person doesn't have any assets under their name, it's not mm-hmm. legal. You know, a judgment won't even be worth the paper it's written on. So I always have that conversation in my consultation. this is how much I think it's going to cost. You have to decide ultimately a cost benefit. Is this worth it for you? And if it is, let's go for it. But I need you to have realistic expectations about what you can get out of the process.
So we talked through actual maintenance. The second category or part of that financial umbrella of divorce is child support. I know child support is really complicated, so I kind of just want to like briefly touch on it. But from the presentation that you did, there were a couple of things you mentioned that I was pretty surprised to hear, which I'll get to in a second. But can you just first talk about what are the general factors that go into determining child support payments and which parent owes what to who?
Yeah, so there's three main factors. One is the parenting schedule. And the parenting schedule, in legal terms, the only thing that matters is where the children sleep at night. So, you know, if it's a 50-50 schedule or it's an every other weekend schedule or some kind of hybrid in the middle, that's part of the formula. The other part is obviously the payor's income and the payee's income. Sometimes there is no child support in a case if both parties make approximately the same amount and they have an approximately similar parenting schedule. There is no child support. It's just reserved. That's what we say. But because the law was changed a few years ago, it's actually possible to have more than 50% of parenting time and still be required to pay child support. Maybe because you make so much more money than the other party, the courts want children to have a similar lifestyle in both homes. They don't want to live like king. They don't want children to live like kings in one home and poverty in the other. So this is the court's attempt to kind of normalize the children's lifestyle in both homes.
Okay. One thing that you mentioned from the session that you did that kind of surprised me, if you could elaborate on, was that child support is not for extracurricular, educational, or medical expenses. Can you elaborate on that and then also talk about what are the eligible expenses that the recipient of child support can spend that money on?
Yeah, so child support, like I mentioned, the law changed a few years ago. So it significantly reduced child support, actually, when the law changed. And child support is meant to be used for like normal living expenses. So think about electricity, shoes for the kids, groceries in the fridge, gasoline in the car, things like that. Out-of-pocket expenses, like you mentioned, educational, extracurricular, medical, and sometimes I throw in religion in there as well, are additional expenses. So I'm talking about school fees, books, you know, soccer practice, tutoring, things like that. Even sometimes religious classes I throw in there. Those get divided separate and apart from child support, which is often hard for the payor to hear that they have to pay an unknown sum on top of monthly child support. But that expense, you know, it gets divided to some extent between the parties, whether it's 50-50 or sometimes I do it in proportion to each party's incomes. If there's a significant discrepancy between their incomes,
So like if the kid breaks their arm and they have some exorbitant emergency room fees, that would be handled separately aside from the recurring existing child support payments.
Right. Even like a copay, you know, for an annual visit, a $20 copay should get divided between the parties because child support's not supposed to cover those things.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay. All right. Let's move on and talk about the last part of the financial category of divorce, which is the marital estate. So all the assets and debt that each person has and how that's going to be allocated in the divorce. And I've heard oftentimes this part of the divorce is, you know, the part that causes things to get drawn out the most. But before we dive into that, can you elaborate or explain the difference between joint community states and equitable distribution states? Because I understand that state regulation will play a huge role in how the assets get divided if a prenup wasn't in place.
Right. So like you said, you know, divorce law, family law, whatever you want to call it, is state law. It's not federal law. So it's different state by state. In Illinois, the idea is that we equitably divide the marital estate, which basically means anything that was earned during the marriage by either party is marital property, regardless of how it's titled or who's holding it. We just try to equitably divide it. That doesn't equitably doesn't necessarily mean equal. It doesn't mean 50-50. We just try to balance it out so it's fair. We could talk for hours about what is fair in the court system. You know, different judges have different opinions, different attorneys have different opinions, and I guarantee you my clients have different opinions than I do. But there are general guidelines. After practicing for so many years, I kind of know the way a marital estate is going to end up looking like. When we talk about community prop or joint community or community property states, I believe that's the minority of states in America. Mm-hmm. And that's simply it's significant because there still is marital property, but I believe that titling plays a more significant role. So for example, if husband buys a car and that car is in husband's name, even if it was bought during the marriage, it will be husband's. It will be awarded to husband at the time of divorce. That's my understanding of it. But that being said, you know, I have limited experience outside of Illinois. So okay. My brain works in terms of equitable distribution.
Okay. So in Illinois, which is equitable distribution, you mentioned that it does not matter how things are titled. And I was surprised to hear that, because I think that's a common misconception, because I've heard people say, well, the title is only mine, so he or she can't get any part of it. And that may not actually be the case.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's a very, very common misconception. You know, people will say, the house is under my name, it's my house, or the house is under his name and I don't get any part of that. And I love saying, no, it's actually yours as well, you know, because Illinois looks at where the source of the funds came from. So when you're married, his money is your money is his money. Even if you decide to keep it in separate bank accounts, the law really considers everything to be joint. So you can't circumvent the law just by titling things in a certain way unless you have a prenup.
Mm-hmm. So let's say like you have a 401k that's your own. You have it with your employer. Your spouse has no part of it. He's never seen it. And that 401k is worth $100,000 at the time of marriage, and it grows to $175,000 at the end of the marriage. Does that mean that $75,000 growth is subject to being part of this like marital estate?
No. So the growth as a result of assets that already existed before the marriage, the growth part of that stays non-marital. But any contributions during the marriage or growth from contributions during the marriage would be marital. So it's kind of hard to wrap your mind around. And
yeah,
as a client, you would think, how am I supposed to know that? You know, the market changes. I lost money this year. I gained money this year. That's where I come in. You know, I work with actuaries and valuators and pension valuators to analyze exactly what happened and divide it. And I have mechanisms to divide these kind of complicated investment vehicles at the time of divorce.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what happens to the engagement ring when you go through a divorce. How is that looked at in a courtroom?
Yeah, so this is a pretty common question, actually, and the law is pretty well settled on this as well. So an engagement ring is basically, I'm blanking on the word, consideration. It's consideration to get married. So if the engagement breaks off before you get married, the engagement ring goes back to the person who bought the ring. But once the parties are married, the consideration has been fulfilled. And so the engagement ring would then belong to the recipient.
Okay, so that person can keep that engagement ring and do with it as they please legally.
And it's not part of the marital estate.
Got it. Okay, mm-hmm. So interesting. So we can see how complicated it can be, like figuring out how to split, you know, your assets in a divorce. So let's talk about prenups, because in theory, divorces, you know, can often become more simplified both in terms of time and cost, if there was a prenup in place. Mm-hmm. So talk to us about what a prenup is and when they are recommended, you know, and like what circumstances does it make most sense for couples to sign a prenup?
Yeah, I mean, the answer to that is complicated. It's never and always, because it really boils down to, do you like the contract that the state has drafted up for you? When you get married, you're entering into a legal contract, right? And you're agreeing to a certain set of terms that are laid out in the law. And no one does their research. No one knows what these terms are.
Mm-hmm.
Basically agreeing to this contract. So you don't need a prenup if you're happy with the terms laid out in the law. The law was designed to be as fair as possible. That being said, yes, there's also a lot of litigation because there's a lot of gray area. So a prenup is really good for someone who doesn't like the way the law is drafted. It's really good for people who have family businesses that kind of get commingled. I see that a lot. It's really good for people who follow a religion that has guidelines on how to divorce assets at the how to divide assets at the time of divorce. So a lot of my Muslim clients will get prenups because they have another set of rules that they'd like to follow, and they'd like to opt out of Illinois' laws. So there's a lot of good reasons, but it's not for everybody. I mean, if you think the law is fair and you aren't coming into the marriage with very many assets, and there are additional complications, then there's no need for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of stigma around prenups, you know, like people kind of feeling like, oh, if you're doing a prenup, that means there's doubt or there's possibility that this marriage might not work out, et cetera. Do you see South Asian clients drafting prenups? Like, what's been kind of your experience?
I'm a big advocate of prenups. I see how expensive divorces can be, how they can literally put people into bankruptcy. And so for that reason, I think of prenups as an insurance policy. You've taken the time to think about what happens in a worst case scenario. It's just an insurance policy. Spend a couple of grand, do a prenup, and then you don't have to worry later when you get into a fight, you know?
Yeah.
It's very common getting divorced, you know, divorces are on the rise in the South Asian community. It's a concern for our community. And there's no need to put yourself in a situation that you don't actually need to be in. I know hindsight's 20/20 for a lot of people. And I'm not saying for anyone to beat themselves up. I'm just saying, it's a great insurance policy. I know there is stigma surrounding it. I know it takes some of the romance out of being married. But people who get divorced, who have prenups, are always so thankful that they have.
Yeah, I like that you compared it to insurance, because nobody gets in their car thinking that they're going to get into an accident. But if it does, they're really glad that they had one. And I think in most situations, you know, you're a lot better off figuring out who's going to get what when you're level-headed and still in love with each other. I've heard things like people putting in stipulations around cheating within the prenup, like, you know, if the divorce happens due to infidelity, the wife gets X. Like, are those legally enforceable terms?
Yeah, so it's still actually a bit of a gray area. I think that if you are trying to put in what's it's called a lifestyle clause. If you're trying to put that in, you should assume it's unenforceable. It's primarily put in prenups as more of a deterrent for certain kind of behavior, but you know, the law will always change, unfortunately, for predictability. You know, the law will always change. So just a few years ago, Illinois became a no-fault divorce state. So you can't give infidelity as a reason for getting divorced. And it remains to be seen what extent that would affect that kind of lifestyle clause within a prenup. So what I would do is I would include it, but I also would put in what's called a severability clause, which basically says that if a judge finds this particular clause to be unenforceable, the rest of the prenup shall still remain in full force. It's tricky, and I don't generally recommend it, but
yeah. So interesting. I mean, my views on prenups have evolved over the years. If you asked me at 25 if I was open to a prenup, I'd say no. But now at 31, I'd say yes, I'm totally open to getting a prenup. And I think, you know, that comes from like getting a little bit older. You start to make more decisions that will really shape your future. And now that I'm in my 30s, like I'm seeing more of the divorces happening. Like in your 20s, you see all the weddings and marriages, and then and in your 30s, you start to see more of the divorces rolling through. And that's just the reality of life. And I've kind of like witnessed how complicated and messy and extremely costly as well divorce can be, not only in legal fees, but it can also create like huge financial burdens well after a divorce is settled too, like what we talked about. But you know, my partner Aaron and I, like, we're not married, but we're very open about money with each other, and we've talked about prenups, and we're both open to the idea. And if we ever get married, we probably will sign a prenup. And you know, I don't see it as doing like a prenup because I don't think the marriage will last, but I've just really trained my brain to see it more rationally and kind of like, I think if you can remove the emotions and like feelings associated with it, prenups make sense. I did a little Instagram poll on my personal Instagram page this week, and mind you, it's just a simple Instagram poll, don't take it too seriously, but I was pretty surprised to see that in the poll, like I asked unmarried people if they were open to a prenup before marriage, and there were 74 people that voted, and 73% said they were open to a prenup. So I was pretty shocked to see that split. But I mean, I heard a divorce attorney say in a different podcast how criminal law brings the good out in bad people and divorce law brings the bad out in good people. And I thought that was really insightful. And again, you know, you're better off making these huge decisions while you're still level-headed.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think that my client, I don't get to see the best versions of my clients. They are, yeah, they're going through one of the worst things of their lives. And I try to be empathetic for that reason. But when it comes to prenups, you know, even if you do get a big inheritance or you do have some large non-marital property, I don't advocate for prenups just for the sake of it. If you understand the law in your state and you're okay with how that law applies and frankly protects you to some extent, if you're okay with that, then there's no need for a prenup. But I always recommend just know what you're getting into from a legal perspective and you decide whether you want to opt in or not. I always tell people, understand the law and go to premarital counseling.
I think it's so important that people like even learn about this kind of stuff, like divorce and what all it can entail before you get married. And also talking about finances and all of your assets and debt, because, you know, whether or not you choose to get a prenup or not, I think one added benefit of a prenup is that one of the requirements of a prenup is that you have to disclose 100% of all of your assets and debt, right? Otherwise, the prenup is void.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so important to do before you get married. I think everyone who's getting married should have multiple sit-down conversations reviewing each other's personal financial statements. Like, you should be able to walk through how you translate onto an income statement and balance sheet, because legally, when you get married, that becomes part of marital property. And I think as uncomfortable as that may be, it's so important to do. And not that a prenup is required to do that, but again, one benefit of going through the prenup process, if you choose to, it forces you to disclose all of that information by default and have those important conversations.
Yeah, I think that's really insightful. I mean, there's so much research that, you know, financial difficulties and different financial kind of ways to move about through the world, financial styles, I don't know, there's a term for it, but that how that contributes to divorces. So I'm a big advocate of, you know, having those conversations, being transparent, because that will actually help your marriage in the long run, right? That level of transparency.
Yeah. Let's say a couple is married, but they have not signed a prenup, but want to have something similar in place to protect both parties. I've heard of postnups being a thing. Can you talk about a postnup and whether they're truly valid and can be upheld in a court of law? I ask that because I've heard varying things about postnups.
Yeah, post-ups are great, and they're not common, I would say, but they absolutely can be, held up in a court of law as long as they're done properly. You know, disclosure of assets, and each party needs to get their own attorney, and, you know, that level of disclosure needs to still take place. But post-ups are great for people who are, you know, coming into an inheritance or realize that their family business might be a little messy, things like that. But I would say they're uncommon because if people are getting a post-nup, they've already spent time in operating under Illinois law. And the fact that they want to change that in the context of their relationship indicates to me often that there's actually marital trouble, and what they really want to do is get a divorce. So when I do post-nups, it's usually the result of someone filing for divorce, us going through the process for a while, deciding that they then want to reconcile with their partner, and then putting a post-nup in place so they don't have to go through this process again. That's where I see it happen most common. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's certainly enforceable, and it works very similar to a prenup.
Got it. What kind of advice do you have for someone who is considering divorce but has not broken the news to their spouse yet?
I mean, from a practical perspective, you need to start taking pictures of things like an insurance statement lying around or a bank account statement lying around. Because when the other person knows that a divorce is coming their way, they might start hiding assets. And to be honest, I can find hidden assets most of the time. Mm-hmm. Almost everything has a paper trail, so people aren't sneaky as they think they are. But to kind of circumvent the labor that goes into hunting down assets, just take pictures. Uh-huh. Take pictures of the jewelry that you might have lying around, the jewelry that your partner might have lying around before that jewelry disappears and we never hear about it ever again. So do some of that preliminary information gathering for me so I have proof later down the line if they deny certain assets exist. And then I would say just have your support system in place. You know, tell your friends, tell your family. This is such a traumatic thing to go through. I always say that, and I keep saying it because I do see how my clients struggle. Have your support system in place so that when you do break the news, you have somewhere safe to go. You have somewhere where you can just, you know, take a breath, call your divorce attorney in peace, and make a plan to move forward.
Mm-hmm. I know we're almost out of time, so one last question. What are some of the unique situations that you've seen come up specific to South Asian divorce clients, whether it's like gold or other things like that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most common issues that I see in most South Asian divorces is the jewelry given to the parties at the time of the marriage. So Illinois law is pretty settled on this matter that gifts given in for the marriage, it's a marital gift. It's a gift to the couple. And that's something to really consider and think about when your family might give you like an heirloom, right? That's meant to stay in the family. It would be devastating to lose that heirloom in the divorce to your ex, which is another reason why prenups are great, right? You can uh-huh. prenup those assets. So gold is always an issue. Family heirlooms are almost always an issue. Meher is basically a sum of money the husband would give to the wife in an Islamic divorce. Mm-hmm. That tends to be a pretty big issue in my Islamic Muslim cases because it's actually not legally enforceable, which is another reason why prenups are great. We can make that enforceable. What else? I mean, I would also say that extended families tend to get more involved in divorce cases. You know, in-laws, cousins, they try to do mediation on the side, things like that. And joint families that share assets and bank accounts. It is really difficult to divide a bank account that belongs to three different families simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So that's a complicated issue. It's pretty unique to South Asian families. And I do feel like the judges in the area I practice are not that well-versed in these issues, which is why it's so important to have a a culturally competent attorney, whether mm-hmm. it's me or the person that represents the children or the judge. Someone in the room needs to understand how these things work so that they can explain it to everybody else in the courtroom. And I spend a lot of my time educating opposing counsels and judges about these things because it's just so foreign to them. Whereas for me, you know, I grew up in this community and I understand the ins and outs of it.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned with jewelry, like in Illinois law, you mentioned that it is pretty settled on jewelry that's given as a marital gift.
It's pretty settled, yeah. Okay. I mean, there are definitely...
And so what is the typical outcome in Illinois?
So if it doesn't go to trial, what I like to do is, you know, everyone gets their own stuff back. So if wife's family gave the couple stuff, she gets to keep that stuff and husband's family gets to keep his stuff. Usually the sentimental value often even overrides the monetary value. People just want their own things back when it comes to that. But if it gets really contentious and there isn't the sentimental factor involved, you would take the value of all of the jewelry or watches or whatever it might be, and you sell it and you divide the proceeds in half, or one person keeps it and buys the other person out. Mm-hmm. And it's always tragic for it to get to that stage, but judges don't know how else to deal with this issue. There is no special exception in the law for Indian gold.
Right. What about gold that you had prior to the marriage? Like, let's say you had a gold bracelet that was yours. Yeah. Does that become part of the quote marital estate and subject to division, or is that's yours?
Well, it's non-marital. So if you have a retirement account before you got married, a bank mm-hmm. account before you got married, jewelry, personal assets, real estate even, it's all non-marital. I would just warn people against commingling, which basically means, you know, if you have a gold bracelet, keep the gold bracelet as is. And if you decide to sell it, keep that money separate from the rest of your marital estate. Don't use the gold bracelet to buy a house and then later say, oh, part of that house was bought from the gold bracelet. I want my part separate. It's commingled at that point. So like I said, the law, it doesn't always work against you. It also protects you. As long as you keep your things separate in the appropriate way, a judge will say, that's your non-marital property. He can't touch it. I don't care that you've been married for 40 years.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. Well, Maliha, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us about this topic and giving so much insight. How can people get in touch with you if they want to work with you or utilize your services?
Yeah, so thank you so much for having me. I am on Instagram and Facebook at Siddiqui Family Law. But you can find me on my website, SiddiquiFamilyLaw.com. You can, you know, my phone number's on there. You can text me, you can call me, you can email me, and we'll get in touch.
Awesome. Yeah. And I'll be sure to include all of those links in the show notes.
Awesome.